Time now for a catch-up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, protests in Portugal at plans to address water shortages and further disruption for UK travellers entering the EU. But first, we go to Kenya, where a wave of deadly violence against women has sparked outrage and impassioned calls for action. In January 2024 alone, 16 women lost their lives to gender-based killings across the country. As a result, rights groups and campaigners are now calling for urgent action and for femicide to be recognised as a criminal offence in its own right. Caitlin Kelly met with some of those shining a light on the issues.
As the world celebrates International Women's Day, Kenya is in mourning. According to local reports, 30 women have been murdered since the start of the year, igniting an intense nationwide debate. Notable for their brutality and gender-based nature, these murders have caused a public outcry. On the 14th of February, I joined hundreds of women at the University of Nairobi who gathered for Dark Valentine, one of several vigils held across Kenya, honouring those who've lost their lives. Romantic dinner plans gave way to an evening clad in black, as the vigil marked another moment of action in the ongoing battle against what local rights groups term a femicide pandemic. Defined by UN Women as intentional killings with a gender-related motivation, femicide has claimed over 500 lives in Kenya since 2016. The majority of these murders were carried out by perpetrators who had known their victims intimately, often within romantic relationships. One of the recent victims was Rita Waini, a 20-year-old student. On the 14th of January, Rita was killed and dismembered in a short-term rental property in Nairobi. Days before that, popular Instagram figure, 26-year-old Starlet Wahu, was fatally stabbed by a man she met online, also in a short-term rental. Thousands took to the streets in late January in response to these killings, carrying placards emblazoned with hashtags like Stop Killing Us and We Just Want to Live, demanding legal and social reforms to better protect women. I spoke to Marilyn, Antonia and Martha from the leading advocacy group End Femicide KE. They first joined forces to end the systemic violence against women in 2019. Their laughter, like that of sisters, peppered our conversation, revealing the depth of their shared experience and the journey they've been on together. Martha tells me that low education levels combined with religious and cultural norms of purity contribute to what she deems a patriarchal society. Antonia explains that even finding the word patriarchy in some of Kenya's local languages is difficult. They both go on to mention the negative impacts of the country's economic uncertainty, particularly for women. Hence why End Femicide KE's proposed policy reforms mention inclusive economic development. UN Women representative in Kenya, Anna Mutavati, believes negative and harmful social norms are the key obstacle. According to her, there's a lot of work to be done to combat biased societal perceptions. She points to the role of individuals on social media who perpetuate the normalization of these violent acts. When reeling off the list of reasons for this rampant misogyny, as she calls it, Martha cites the manosphere that is being perpetuated online. She mentions the hashtag Masculinity Saturdays, a platform with a large following that preaches male dominance and hypermasculine ideologies. Gender-based violence is a long-standing problem in Kenya. According to a 2022 national survey, at least 34% of women recounted that they had experienced physical violence. And survivor support organisation Usikime, Swahili for Don't Be Silent, receives around 15 calls and messages a day from victims of sexual and gender-based violence. Kenya has adopted UN treaties that tackle gender-based violence, and national laws like the Sexual Offences Act criminalise violence against women. Speaking earlier this year, Harriet Chigai, President Ruto's advisor on the issue, reiterated the government's commitment to ending all forms of violence against women. But it's clear that the women of Kenya are demanding more decisive action, as over 270 local groups have signed a statement urging the government to recognise femicide as a distinct legal charge. I reflect on how I spent my Valentine's Day and think about the love that brought together the women at the vigil. Despite the sombre occasion, the message was one of hope and solidarity, as musical performances and rousing words from local artists and activists filled the air, echoing a collective determination to end this violence. Their resilience and resolve is reminiscent of the survivors of sexual and gender-based violence I've interviewed in the UK. The scene also looked familiar, much like the vigils held across Ireland and Britain for victims like Aisling Murphy or Sarah Everard. This International Women's Day also marks yet another day where, By UN estimates, 133 women have been killed by an intimate partner or family member. Leaving the vigil and weaving home through the dense Nairobi traffic, I couldn't get Marilyn's words out of my head. Our siblings were murdered. Demanding that the change happens is not only for them, but for the ones who are still left alive. For World Report, this is Caitlin Kelly in Nairobi, Kenya.
To the Algarve in Portugal next, where a lack of rainfall over the past 2 years has led to water shortages. To deal with the problems, the government has proposed building a new desalination plant to make seawater drinkable. But the proposal has been met with strong opposition from some of the people living in the area where the plant is to be built due to the discharge and runoff from the plant. Conor Power reports.
At the Pine Cliffs Resort near Albufeira on Portugal's southern Algarve region, the blustery wind is bending the palm trees, and it has been raining hard for 2 whole days. This is unusual, but very much welcomed by those who live here. Irish friends of mine who live nearby told me recently that they had only seen 1 day of rain in the last 18 months. There are a lot of foreign residents on the Algarve. Digital nomads and retirees have swelled the ranks of the estrangeiros who come for the sunny climate, low cost of living, liberal economy and the affable Portuguese themselves. But as with all things, there is a cost. The problem of water supply has always existed in many parts of Portugal, but in recent years the increase in population, coupled with the acute lack of rain over the last 2 years, have brought that problem to new levels on the Algarve. All municipalities on the coastal region now have to find a way of reducing their water usage by 15% if they're to avoid serious problems in the busier months to come. Meanwhile, the Portuguese government have come up with the solution of building a desalination plant. Desalination plants that convert seawater into fresh water are nothing new, and Portugal's first desalination plant on the island of Madeira now supplies all of the island's water needs. Desalination plants also have a cost, however. Apart from the economic one of building it in the first place, they require a significant amount of energy, and there is a daily runoff of an estimated 60,000 tonnes of chemically treated concentrated brine. Last summer came the announcement that it was going to be built near the town of Albufeira. This is right in the middle of the Algarve coastline and close to beaches that are popular with holidaymakers. The runoff is due to discharge into the sea via a 1.8 kilometre long pipeline from the beautiful Praia da Falésia. On the day before those 2 days of torrential rain, there was a protest against the desalination plant on that very beach, just below where I was staying. It was organised by the Foreign Residents Association of the Algarve. The group plans to take up the issue directly with the European Commission, the direct source of the €50 million budget being used to construct the proposed plant. The Foreign Residents group also plans to run in the 2025 legislative elections. There are officially over 1 million foreign residents in Portugal, with a disproportionately high number of them living on the Algarve. The desalination plant, they say, is not the answer to the growing problems of water scarcity, a fact recently admitted by the president of AMAL, the local government administrative body. Instead of spending €50 million on this plant, they say that the government needs to concentrate on reducing water wastage, estimated at 30%, and on looking at recycling water. Currently, Portugal recycles only 1% of its water, whereas in countries such as Germany or the Netherlands, that figure is between 85 and 95%. Águas de Algarve, the company behind the project, say that the discharge will go far out to sea and will be quite harmless. But those assurances have been dismissed, not only by the Foreign Residents Association, but also by the official environmental impact study, carried out jointly by Lisbon-based Organisation Zero and Algarve-based Amalgam. Sarah Correa, project officer at Zero, says that they are not against a desalination plant per se, but that they have great doubts that the project will contribute to the objectives defined in the environmental impact study, which are to guarantee the resilience of public supply to the region's population and to guarantee the availability of water for current and future consumption. The desalination plant should be, she says, a measure of last resort, to be considered only after other efficiency measures have been implemented first. In the case of the Algarve, says Sarah, these measures that should have come first were clearly not implemented. Rather than concentrating on promoting demand for water, the government should focus on measures aimed at reducing demand. That is to say, in investing in reduction in losses of supply, limiting the expansion of irrigated areas, and limiting the installation of permanent monocultures that represent large water needs. The proposed site of the plant, 4 kilometres from the coast, is on lands belonging to the Ferrero family. They had planned to seek permission to build a retirement home on their property, but instead they received a compulsory purchase order from Aguas do Algarve a year ago, stating a purchase price of €600,000. According to owner Albida Ferrero, this figure is a fraction of the €15 million that her property has been valued at. The Portuguese government argues that this is an important, albeit imperfect, solution to the Algarve's serious water scarcity. If that is so, it may yet take some time, with Albida Ferreira saying that, regardless of the price they're paid, they are very much against the desalination plant and that they will fight this to the end. For RTE World Report in Albufeira, Algarve, this is Conor Power.
Finally, to the UK, where the fallout from Britain's decision to leave the European Union has created many challenges for the British economy, such as new rules on trade. The UK claims to have ironed out problems that caused traffic queues of several kilometres long for holidaymakers and lorries waiting to enter the port of Dover. But the authorities are worried that a new challenge for travellers will emerge later this year. The Mayor of London has warned of chaos when the European Union introduces a new system to register the biometric details of travellers entering the bloc who are not EU citizens. The Eurostar cross-channel rail service could be severely disrupted, as Russell Padmore reports now from London.
The Eurostar train service linking London to Paris and other European capitals suffered a drop in revenues in 2022, when passenger numbers fell 30% after border checks were introduced following Brexit. The European Union's system to register biometric details of travellers from non-member countries is expected to come into force in October, which should prevent travel disruption for the Olympic Games in Paris in the summer. The automated registration procedure is designed for British and other non-EU arrivals who don't need a visa to enter the Schengen travel area. Irish citizens won't have to use the system. It registers biometric data such as facial scans and fingerprints, plus the date and place of entry and exit. The information will be checked against security databases. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has warned that delays because of the system will hit the city's economy during the key Christmas period. Eurostar is a vital part of London's and the UK's economic success. As it stands, these new post-Brexit checks will cause chaos, he said, warning of huge queues at St Pancras Station. French Customs will have 24 kiosks for the process at the London station, despite studies showing 49 will be needed. Customs officials from France operate at the Port of Dover and St Pancras Station in London, the Eurostar terminal. British and other non-EU travellers are expected to enter personal information, details about their trip, and submit fingerprint and facial biometric data into automated machines. The time it takes to complete the procedure at rail stations, ports and airports will increase significantly. At Dover and the Eurotunnel border checkpoints, it could take an average of 5 to 7 minutes to finish the biometric registration, compared with less than a minute for the current travel requirements. Europe's new border regime is also worrying airlines, which claim it will make travel complicated. Ryanair has told the UK Parliament that the requirements will be very difficult. Airlines will have to verify if passengers are eligible for travel 48 hours before departure, which would deter last-minute decisions to book a flight. Airports may also have to allocate more space for staff to check if passengers have completed biometric registration. The discredited former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson often used the phrase "get Brexit done," but new challenges keep emerging for the UK since the country took the EU exit door. The Port of Dover, which handles about a third of the UK's trade in goods, has raised another problem about border checks. The port has threatened to take the government to court if it doesn't reconsider a plan to move checks on products of animal origin to another site, 32 kilometres inland. The port says there is no mechanism to ensure that vehicles sent for checks will actually go there. "We can't see how these changes are in the best interest of GB biosecurity," said Lucy Manzano. the head of Dover Port Health Authority. Brexit continues to damage the UK economy. A recent study by Cambridge Econometrics found that 2 million jobs were lost and the economy of London has shrunk by £30 billion. That's about €35 billion. No wonder the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, wants closer ties to Brussels. The biometric registration system will be the biggest ever change to procedures for people crossing a border into the EU. It's aimed at improving European security and tackling illegal migration. It may be a nuisance for non-EU travellers to provide fingerprints and a face scan, but the data will last 3 years, making the next visit easier. Irish citizens with European Union passports are exempt from the biometric registration system, so they'll travel freely through ports and airports. Some may look at their British counterparts and feel sympathy for holidaymakers enduring delays from more post-Brexit bureaucracy. But others may take adverse pleasure from the problem the British brought upon themselves by leaving the European Union. This is Russell Padmore in London for World Report.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.